button. Today, I am joined by esteemed member of the 7-Point Highlander Committee, Aunt Volte.
Hi, everyone. My name's Aunt Volte. I'm on the 7-Point Committee. I'm also a content creator for the format and arguably one of the best players in the country. Hello, everyone. How are you going?
I have said before that you are one of the best players I have ever met in my entire life.
I would hope so. I've played this game for a long time.
How long have you been playing for?
Since I was 6 or 7, so 25 years-ish at this point. And I don't think any of the breaks I took were longer than half a year, so pretty consistently close to 25 years, which is, you know, I can vote, which is nice.
Your magic career can also vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, you pick up on some things if you play for that long. I'm still rubbish at some things, but, you know, you get pretty good at some of the nitty-gritty.
Well, and I've brought you here today because now a little bit time gone past was Canbrawl, which was a 100-plus player event put on by Pat. And you built, I think, the most interesting deck of the entire event. And I don't think it comes close. And so you built was it $150?
Yes.
$150 as of time of deck submission, Highlander deck.
Mm-hmm.
And Highlander, for those in our audience who are, you know, more standard, modern, you know, 7-Point Australian Highlander is a vintage format that has some of the most powerful cards ever printed in Magic legal in the format. You've got your Black Lotuses, your Time Twisters, your Time Walks, Wheel of Fortunes, all your dual lands and everything. And so there were many times during the event where your entire deck, they had, you know, they have a Caracas on the field. Sorry, not Caracas. They have a Tabernacle on the field.
Mm, yeah.
And it's 500 times the price of your deck. So why set yourself this challenge?
So realistically, I think one of the big things about people trying to get into Highlander, which is a lot of the emerging audience that I have, is it's just kind of daunting to be like, I want to try this format that everyone in Australia plays. What do you mean the average price of a deck is $4,000?
Yeah, it's up there.
And so, you know, if you don't already have a collection that enables you to move into Highlander, there is the accessibility rule in place, but even the 8-point decks of the format still go for 1.5, 1.4, and that is the, you know, competitively viable ones. So eventually, I started a budget series on YouTube where I built $75 decks, which is, you know, average of a dollar a card. And you'd play them at weeklies. You would maybe go 2-2 or 1-3 if the deck functioned really well or if you got a bit lucky. And then I found out after making all of these decks, I think it was, you know, 15 or so, that I hadn't played any of them at an actual major event. Mm-hmm. I'd played some at weeklies. I had tested some on Moto for proof of concept, but I hadn't put my money where my mouth was. And it's very easy to say, oh, here's a budget deck. You could totally do well with it when you probably won't. You know, if someone cracks a fetch land, there is a decent chance it is more expensive than your deck. the land that they get is going to be 10x the price of your deck.
Yeah.
And that's just a land that taps for mana. And if you account for all of the cards in people's decks, you kind of get dwarfed pretty quickly. And so if you're working within a budget, you need to have a deck that functions pretty much perfectly and does all the things it needs to do. Otherwise, if you're just playing a normal mid-range deck that is priced down, you're going to lose pound for pound on every single card interaction, and it's not going to work. You won't win any games of Magic. So I want to build a budget deck. I want to take it to a big event. I want to see what happens. And at first, I started with 75. I realized that realistically, anyone who's trying to get into the format is probably willing to spend a little bit more on that budget. So I set the arbitrary number of 150, $2 a card. Let's see what happens. And I sat there building decks over and over again, reiterating over and over again. I went through 6 or 7 different archetypes trying to find something that looked viable. I eventually figured out that mono white was probably somewhat viable. because, you know, you probably have to be a monocolor deck, and out of the monocolor decks, the most expensive cards tend to be in blue and black because you have Force of Will and Nethergoyf and whatnot. But the white cards, the most expensive cards, are the, you know, some of the lands and one or two of the creatures. But the rest of your creatures are pretty cheap. You know, you get Mother of Runes for like $2. You get, and that's easily one of the best cards in your deck.
Mm-hmm.
You get Skullclamp for $4. You know, you can play 11 basics and actually be paid off for having a really stable mana base.
And your basics are free.
Yeah.
Your basics don't cost anything.
If you decide to play Snow Basics, they cost 35 cents each.
Okay.
Which put me over budget. So I cut the On Thin Ice and restructured the deck to get $3 back.
And so you iterated on, like, even as you were, you know, you switched through archetypes, you decided on mono white. You even then restructured the style of the mono white deck that you built because you went over your $150 budget.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every single time I would get to 149, I would realize that the deck needed this thing.
Yeah.
And that card would cost $2.50, which meant I had to find a different card to cut. And then I would cut that card and realize now that this interaction suite is worse and I'm unable to beat this certain archetype. So I'd add a card back in or I'd move things around. And, you know, when things like Get Lost and Dismember are very, very good, but they cost $5.50, you make the concession that I probably don't get to have removal that is as good as I need it to be. And there are already such a large chunk of the budget that is basically locked in just mm-hmm. to make the deck function at all. So thankfully, it wasn't working with a $150 that I was moving around constantly. It was closer to 40, maybe 50, because Caracas, Strip, Waste, and once you've got those three, you're at 40 already, and I don't think you can build any kind of 8-point budget deck without some amount of gas within your points. So yeah, you know, I kept iterating, I kept moving creatures around, I kept moving spells around. I was trying to work out how much of my budget I could dedicate to my sideboard. It was actually a really, really fun deck building challenge that took a long time to get to the finished product. And once I got to that point, I was at an impasse. I have an event in a week. I'm traveling for 15 hours there and back to play this event. It is going to be $30 to $40 of entry. I'm going to have to pay for food while I'm at this weekend. All of that is going to eclipse the budget of my deck.
I was going to say, you're paying more just to go to the event to play the deck at a big event than you spent on the deck entirely.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, when you are looking at your collection and you are looking at this deck that is in a box that has cost you $150, and you know that you are traveling for 15 hours and spending 3 days and you might go 0-3 drop. And then you look at the stock Grixis deck with 5 dual lands in it that is next to that box and ask yourself, should I just play this deck? Probably get a bunch of money back playing the event. It's a hard choice. And I think if I wasn't a content creator who had a goal in mind, I probably would have chickened out. But at the same time, what if it works? You know, what if all of the random thought experiments that you came up with, and what if all of the hours you spent on Moxfield re-updating to cheapest printing and trying to work out what your deck actually looks like when all the card arts are unfamiliar? That one's a fun one, you know, when you just lose track of what cards you have or don't have in your deck mm-hmm. because, I mean, I don't know what a Valley of Gorgonoth is. Like, what do you mean I don't get to look at Wasteland and know that I have a Wasteland in my deck when I'm planning?
Yeah, that's like the Lord of the Rings, like, box topper version, right?
Yeah. It's the same with the White Tower of Echelon, I think it is, which is the Caracas printing.
That's I will say that's the one thing whenever I do commentary with Jimbo, he loves having me because I can recognize all of the alternate arts and the secret layers because I'm face first in cards pretty much every single day at work. And so he's like, oh, thank goodness someone recognized, you know, this specific secret layer expressive iteration because I didn't know what that was.
Yeah. I mean, it happened multiple times in testing and in a weekly prior where I drew a card, didn't recognize it by its art because I just picked up the version that existed at, you know, my LGS, for example. And so I had to read the card and be like, oh, it's that. Okay, sure. Play it. My opponent's like, what is this? And I'm like, it's this card. Like, Weathered Wayfarer was a big one because it was the Fallout Commander printing.
Oh, yeah.
Which has a different border to the one that you normally
different
see.
Border,
has a
different art.
And it's already an uncommon card that people don't expect to see.
So that's the planes grabbing one, isn't it?
Not quite. It is white for a 1/1 with white tap, search your library for a land, put it into your hand.
But only if an opponent has more lands than you.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is designed as a way to offset the play draw rule, but there are very few cards that can shoot if a strip mine that don't cost a lot of money or are in green. This does that, and that's pretty good. When you spend $40 and 3 points on three of your lands, it's kind of nice to see them a bit more often. So that card hard carried quite a few matchups.
Well, and you mentioned as well, like, there's this kind of fear of, you set yourself this really, really intense challenge of $150 US Highlander deck in a field where, you know, the quote unquote, like, cheapest playable deck that I've seen is like an iteration of Kyle Gibson's 8-point Dimir. And even on Moxfield, that's like $850 US at its lowest. I think it's gone up a bit, you know, depending as cards go in and out. So setting yourself like an immense challenge, traveling, paying entry, having to pay to get there, pay for accommodation and all of that. And then this fear of, and then what if I bomb?
Yeah.
And what if I bomb out? But can you tell me how you did at the event? Just really quickly, can you remind me?
Yeah, so it was a 7 Swiss round event with a cut to top 8. Mm-hmm. And I was playing a deck that was $150 in a room where the average price for a deck would have been 4.5, I would say. There were 3 Lotuses in the room, if I'm not mistaken. I was 5-0. I found 2 IDs. I then won my quarters and then lost the semis for a top 4 finish in a 107 player event. So pretty good day out, I would say.
How much do you think of that? Like, one, you are an incredible pilot. Like, you pilot decks to the nth degree, like, on the thinnest lines. And your skill as a player is very, very high. How much of your performance do you think not only was you are probably one of the best players in that room, and the surprise element of people having no idea what your deck does, not knowing what its lines are, not necessarily knowing how to interact, not knowing what to expect? Kind of, what was the line between these two things?
I think it would be 90-10, mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit less, but realistically, the deck isn't the kind of rogue deck that actually picks up rogue deck equity. Mm-hmm. So if you're playing a kind of janky combo deck, you might be able to get away with something where someone kills the wrong creature, for example, or they don't kill a creature because they think they don't have to. You present Luris as a companion, you play a Thraben Inspector on turn 1, your opponent doesn't need to know what's going on to know that you are probably playing relatively cheap creatures. You will have some amount of interaction. Your mana base will have 10 planes in it. So they can't really be surprised by anything in a way that actually detriments them. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Tarmogoyf in your hand and you see that your opponent is on mono white, you are going to play it on turn 2 and it is going to be the biggest creature on the field. So it doesn't actually matter,
sure.
Right? Yeah, there were spots where some people, you know, chose to kill a creature instead of playing a discard spell, for example. But it's a minuscule amount of movement over the course of an event. It's probably closer to 5%, the rogue deck element. It might be 10. I played some weird sideboard cards which did catch people off guard. But beyond that, most of the cards in the deck interacted with the game state and the board state in a way that was very face up. So once you play a card, your opponent reads it because they've never seen it before. They try and understand what it does.
Yep.
But then that's all the card does.
Yep.
It doesn't do anything more than that hidden away in your deck.
Sure.
You know. So yeah, 5 to 10%. I'll be honest, I played out of my mind over the course of that event. I have played a lot of white creature decks and a lot of Death and Taxes and a lot of Thraben Inspectors in my life. Understanding how to sequence your spells, especially when your entire deck costs one and two, and you're probably going to make all your land drops based on how the deck is built, and you're going to have six different options on turn two, three or four different options on turn one. And if you make the wrong option, because your deck costs $150, you're probably just going to lose on the spot. But if you make the right options, sometimes you get to win games.
I got messaged directly by Trent, who said, have you seen Vi's match against Eldrazi at Canbrawl? And I said, like, I've not got it up right now. And he said, you need to open the stream right now, and you need to go watch this match against Eldrazi. I think my face looked like this the whole time. I think I sat there, jaw on the floor, because you 2-0'd him.
Mm-hmm.
You 2-0'd your opponent, like your like blindfolded hands behind your back. You played that to the T, and it was the most, I think, intimidated I had ever been, like behind a screen, not even like, you know, witnessing this in real life. Because you correct me if I'm wrong, this was a match where you Samwise Caracas strip locked him out of playing. And I'd never seen that specific strip mine lock. Because normally you strip lock someone with Ren and Six, and it's a very, or, you know, now you've got like the Ice Till Explorer strip lock as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of other known ways, you know, in usually green, that you're strip locking someone out of a game. And you were just every single turn, yep, cool, you know, strip mine you, flash in Samwise, get back my strip mine, Caracas put Sam back in my hand. And I just sat there gobsmacked. How many instances like that, you know, did you find yourself just buzzing through the deck, just understanding the lines and just running those plays?
Well, that sequence of Samwise, Caracas, strip slash wasteland, I have built a lot of Samwise Caracas decks because I think Caracas is easily one of the best 1-point cards in the format. It's white. It leads you to play Samwise. Mm-hmm. So there are a bunch of different things you can do with the card. Samwise Mishra's Bauble is one where you can very slowly build a draw engine.
Oh, that's nice.
But the thing with the Caracas Samwise strip lock is that it is one strip a turn, so you don't get to blob all of their lands at once. It is incredibly mana intensive because you have to spend two on Samwise every time and you have to tap the Caracas every time. So that's three mana set aside to strip them every turn. If they have a board, they can kill you. If they just keep making land drops and using the rest of their mana to cast spells, they can kill you. If they have a creature with trample, they can kill you. If they have a removal spell, they can kill you. If they blow up your Caracas, they can kill you. So in order to make that routing as safe as possible, it also becomes as slow as possible. You know, you are delaying how you sequence this. So if you watch the video, you'll notice that I play the strip mine, activate it in my opponent's upkeep. I then play the Samwise and pick up the strip mine. And then assuming that my opponent has done nothing, I will end step the Samwise. But I can also just not. And I can leave the Caracas up in case they try to kill something else, for example. I then untap, play the strip mine from hand, and just leave it there until the opponent's next upkeep. And I think there are one or two turns in that sequence where I just didn't do it because I needed to spend my mana on doing other things that were more productive. Yeah. Because it is a lock, it is glacial, and it does not do anything. It doesn't progress, you know, your Ren and Six to an ulti, for example. A lot of the other things with the deck that came with, you know, experience, for example, Caracas plus Bazzery is a very, very slow creature engine. Thraben Inspector with a skull clamp on it to set up blocks and then cracking the clues to, you know, fill your hand in certain spots and making it land drops. There is a lot of weird things you can do once you have two or three cards that synergize together. But it really comes down to the deck building process that happened, which is if all of your cards are worse than all of your opponent's cards, pound for pound, mm-hmm. you need to maximize your synergy. You need all of your cards to work together to become more than the sum of the parts. And that means when you do eventually play the games, you will draw a bunch of cards that might work together, but you're going to have to figure it out. Because if you don't, you're just playing one mana, two ones, and you're going to get bodied.
Well, and there was a really interesting discussion that happened in the Scapeshift server after this event. Like, we were, everyone at home who wasn't at Canberra was cheering you on, and everyone who was playing at the event, everyone was getting cheered on and supported, and everyone was really, really happy. And you were crushing it. You were 5-0 going into round six, and mm-hmm. you ID'd into top eight. And after the event, you placed top four. There was a lot of chatter in the server about deck list now. I want to build this. Give me the deck list. Like, I'm so excited. I love this deck. You played it so well. And I think you really startled a lot of people by saying, don't build it. And I think that was, you know, kind of shocking to hear. Like, people are like, what do you mean don't build it? You placed top four. The deck is sweet. You drove it like a dream. This was like, you know, sure, it was like an actual tiny little $150 jalopy, but you drove it like a Ferrari. Like, this was the best thing to watch ever. What do you mean don't build it? And you gave a lot of really insightful, like, I'm not telling you this because I'm gatekeeping. I'm not telling you this because I want to keep this, you know, success to myself. You kind of opened up this like new gate of, this is actually not the best version of the deck and you shouldn't build it and here's why.
Yeah. I mean, when I built the deck and before I played the event, I had a rough idea of how a lot of the games mm-hmm. would play out, and I had expectations on what winning the game would look like, what losing the game would look like. A lot of those expectations were somewhat wrong and proven to be not quite accurate once the event actually started. I played against a couple of decks that I didn't expect to see that were a bit more rogue, a couple of cards in certain decks that caught me off guard, for example. And when I say I played out of my mind, I mean I kept running into scenarios that I didn't expect to see and having to pivot and work out how to find a winning line. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. A bunch of my matches were 2-1, for example. And when people see the match on coverage, or when they see the deck list, or when they see just the result, it is very easy to think, oh, this deck has to just be good. But it's not. You know, the deck is restrained by all of the different factors that went into making it. You know, a lot of your cards are very low impact because they're high synergy. All of your cards are worse than everyone else's cards, pound for pound. You have to play every single matchup from behind. It's not, you know, you both start at five out of the 10. You're starting at 2, and you have to eke out as much as you can from every interaction. You have to know exactly what your opponent is planning on doing or likely to do and play around that. And so when the Scapeshift people were like, I'm going to build this. It's really cheap. I'm going to buy everything. I'm going to play it at Weeklies or I'm going to play it at the next big event. And basically, I just didn't want people to buy into a deck because of what they saw. I wanted them to understand what they were getting into. And if you do want to buy the deck and you do want to play the deck, you have to know that the first 6 or 7 tournaments, you might not win a match. You might not even win very many games because you are still going to have to learn everything that the deck can do. And until you get to that point, it's kind of just going to feel like you're playing a bad deck and you're losing a bunch. And this was very specific to Scapeshift. A lot of the people in that server who were interested in the deck are new to Highlander. And, you know, it's very easy to get put off from the format by losing a bunch and not really knowing why or how or what you could have done to change it. And because they'd been playing Constructed Magic, they would have had access to enough cards to build a different budget deck that is simpler and better. The 150 Lurus deck was very much for a standing start. You know, maybe you've got a Commander deck or two. Maybe you've played a little bit of Draft and a little bit of Standard and you just want to get stuck in. And when I talked about the deck and filmed the video, I made it very explicitly clear. This deck is not good. It is very difficult. You will lose a lot, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you want and you're willing to buy into that, go for it. But I did want to not waste a bunch of people's money immediately.
Well, and there's two different elements in this as well. There's the one element where you sit and go, this is not the best version of this deck. This is a content deck. And I think you even said, like, there is a better version of this deck that exists that's probably $1,000, because when you have the ability to funnel money into this deck and this archetype, it can get infinitely better. You know, mm-hmm. $150 as the baseline, there's nothing but improvements that can come from, you know, putting X, Y, or Z into the deck. But I think the other element here that you're touching on is this, like, 95% skill expression.
Yes.
Being able to take the deck and pilot it to a T, to know every which little line. And as you're saying, when you come up against brick walls, understanding, like, do I need to go over the brick wall or around the brick wall? And when you're not familiar with a deck, that can be a really difficult choice, and you try and go through it, and then you know, bruise your knuckles up because you're trying to go through a brick wall. And so part of what happens in these situations, right, is as we've discussed, you know, Magic players love looking at the top 8 decks from any event, and they love copy-pasting.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't win. And they get very frustrated, and they go, this deck, you know, placed top 8. How come I lost? And there's so much that comes down to that level of skill expression. And also, you know, the most winningest deck is not necessarily the best deck for you as a player, or is mm-hmm. necessarily even the best deck.
Yeah, I mean, variance is a huge part of Magic. If you're looking at one event and the lists in that event, maybe it was a good deck for the day, or maybe the person got lucky enough. Realistically, there are a bunch of decks in every format that are regarded as the top decks that you can copy paste or find the stock list for. And as long as the deck is powerful enough at what it's doing, you can just kind of get away with copy pasting, right? It is very, very easy to build stock Grixis, play a Dragon's Rage Channeler, get Delirium, and have a 3-3. And if it hits them 7 times, they're just dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter how you screw up the rest of the game. You played a 1-mana 3-3 with flying, and it killed them. You played a Baragoyf, it was the biggest thing on the board, you attacked with it, oh my god, they're dead. and so there are a lot of decks in a lot of formats, especially the mid-range decks and the aggro decks, where copy-pasting works, and it is an actively good way to get into the format, because you skip all the legwork, you skip all the headaches, you don't have to figure everything out all at once. You can just figure out this deck, try and work out what this deck is trying to do, try and work out how that lines up with everything else. And so one of the big things that I've always advocated for 7-point is, if you can find the stock version of the archetype that you want to play and just start there, you'll probably do a lot better than if you try and build something from scratch or find a weird deck that someone has played and done well with, or take a stock list and change 17 cards. Because there's a reason that those cards are the ones that were in the deck. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that that deck did well. And those two are usually somewhat connected. So it's a very common thing where someone will either play a stock deck but choose the wrong archetype and get bodied for it, or they'll take a stock deck, change too much, and get bodied. And it's very easy to do either of those two things. Yeah.
So what's next? What is next for content for you, for tournaments for you? What's coming up next? Like, you had this great showing at Canbrawl. The next big Highlander event is there's Bassers charity tournament coming mm-hmm. up on November 1st. And then there's also the Plenty of Games Highlander Open Series. There's the Invitational in December.
Yeah, there is a lot going on over the next couple of months. I think the big one is the event to end all events, obviously.
I'm sorry, Pat. How could I possibly forget the Win a Lotus event?
I thought you were just shipping it to me to talk about.
I mean, also.
Yeah, the event to end all events, November 14th to 16th. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be playing. If I don't get an invite to the Invitational, I'll find something to do on the Friday, but I wouldn't be too surprised if I can get one.
I trust.
And then we're all going to be playing for a Lotus, and it's going to be 200 plus players, and I'm hoping that I put everyone in the dirt. I'm hoping that it's with something kind of cool. If it's not, and I default to playing the best deck in the format and just skill diffing everyone, that will be kind of boring and that will make for worse content. But if it wins a Lotus, how much worse could it be?
I was going to say, if it nets you a Lotus, surely that's kind of like, ah, well, you know what? We'll take those.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where the, like, if I'm playing this massive event, I'm hoping to get a video out of it. And if that video is, I want a Lotus, that's great. But if the deck list I played is the exact same stock Grixis deck that 20 other people played, it's not as cool. If I win a Lotus with a deck that no one is playing and no one has ever seen before, that is the best possible outcome.
Yeah.
But if I play that deck and don't win, that video is a little bit worse, but maybe I top eight.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I still get something out of it. That question of what I do has stuck with me for about 6 months.
Hasn't been answered yet.
Has not been answered yet.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of smaller events leading up to November. This weekend is the RC, so there is an RC side event, which is pretty classically like 50, 60 players. Mm-hmm. Then a bunch of events in Melbourne in the lead up. There's the Invitational for POG in December. And then moving into next year after November, there's obviously, you know, CanCon and my Invitational and Isaac's birthday weekend. And there's all these different things that may or may not be happening.
There's lots of ways to play Highlander.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And realistically, I will be attempting to play more because I think it makes for better content. And the commentary team that we are building and that a lot of different places are building, they're all solid. And it's people who aren't as invested in playing and trying to win events. So maybe I, you know, remind the kids of who the GOAT is.
Yeah. it's time to show them who's boss.
Yeah, I think that people have kind of forgotten and the fear of playing against me isn't as widely spread as I would like it to be. Yeah, so I think I'm going to try and become a raid boss again because it is always kind of fun. Like, it's a nice feeling. There was a period a couple of years back where, you know, anyone who paid into me felt worried and felt scared and felt like they were going to lose. And that's a pretty good feeling because, you know, it's kind of fun, you know, little power fantasy. And then I would put them in the dirt and they would feel validated and I would feel validated. So it's a good time.
So the queen's coming back for her crown.
Yeah, yeah. Next year, I have a big project that I plan on doing over the course of the year, which is to start with a budget deck and play it at every event and take the prize winnings from those events and build upon the deck.
Nice.
And I want to see what the deck will look like at the end of the year.
That's super exciting.
It is going to be a very long-term project.
Yeah.
I'm going to play it at weeklies and, you know, add $5 here and play it at monthlies and add $20 here. And hopefully we can get it to an end state where the deck has something like really, really big in it, for example. And that would be cool. And that also gives a very long series for people to look at and be like, okay, if I stick with Highlander and I play it a lot and I play this deck a lot, here's what the end result can look like. Because, you know, as the deck improves physically, you also get to do better and that snowballs, which is pretty cool. So people trying to get into the format are a little bit daunted about, you know, starting from the end point. But if you start at a reasonable early point and try and pick up some stuff along the way, it's a little bit more manageable. Yeah.
Fantastic. I can't wait. That's so exciting.
I haven't decided yet what the starting deck is going to be. I think it's probably going to have Sacred Foundry in it, though. Because I kind of just like Caracas and I like Sacred Foundry.
Could be anything.
It could be anything.
Could be anything then.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Did you want to plug all of your fantastic videos that you work on? Everyone needs to go watch Vi's Force of Will video. It's my favorite video that you've done.
Yeah, yeah.
Where can people find you?
That video has a lot of views, but it can always use more. So I'm at Aunt Vaulty on pretty much everything. I have a YouTube channel. I stream on Twitch multiple times a week. Both of those are Aunt Vaulty. I also have a website that has a blog adjacent on it. Otherwise, you can check out the Patreon, where there's Patreon exclusive posts as well, which is kind of a blog, but kind of a diary, but also like newsy, you know, thoughts of the week is the branding for those posts. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, if you want to check out VFN, which is a tournament series that I run every week, we run a tournament every second Tuesday and one every Friday. So it's a nice way to play Highlander if you're in a remote area or you don't have an LGS that, you know, supports Highlander, for example. You can just play a little bit every now and then. And if you want to check that stuff out and read about it, the website's great, but otherwise joining the Discord server and reaching out, that's great. But yeah, hopefully I get to bring a bunch of really cool and sweet YouTube videos to everyone towards the end of the year. And, you know, if there's a thumbnail of me next to a lotus in December, it's going to be pretty
sweet.
We've
made it.
Yeah, yeah.
We've made it.
That is the goal for the year.
With all that said, that's all we have for you today. We look forward to seeing you again next week. New episodes release on Mondays at 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. You can keep track of all of our releases at RaiseMTG across Instagram and Blue Sky. You can follow me at Kira Bobira, Maya, who is in absentia today, at MayaMTG. And you can find Vi on all of your socials as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at Aunt Bolte?
Yes, Aunt Bolte on pretty much everything.
Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.